Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website. To the sad truth,
the dirty lowdown. Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to our Wednesday Dock of the Rock edition of The Lowdown. This is the day of the week we're reserving to bring you up to date with what's happening in the medical world in our community, at the hospital, at the clinics, from the administrators, doctors, and staff who are on the front lines in Kodiak helping us navigate through this pandemic. I have some questions, but there's always room for yours. We just got a pile of questions in through the email. If you want to shoot us an email, lowdown@kmxt.org. Or call 486-3181, and we'll have the question passed in and try and get it answered before the end of the show. In the studio again today, we have Dr. Evan Jones from Canada. Dr. Steve Smith is back from Providence. Elsa DeHart from Public Health is here. And for the first time this week, we're glad to introduce from the Ambulatory Care Clinic, Dr. John Collar and Dr. Shanna Theobald. Morning. Thank you all for coming. This gives us a great opportunity. We've actually been wanting to get people from your clinic in for a couple of weeks, and I'm glad you made your schedules available to do this. The doctors actually seemed to get pretty excited a couple of weeks ago when we started reading and hearing about your antibody testing, and they wanted to know more information about it. And we frankly, we've been sort of insular here talking with the hospital and KCH, the Kodiak Health Community Health Center, and with CANA, knowing that there's other providers in the community who are probably faced with similar issues in trying to deal with this pandemic. So it's great to be able to talk to with you folks and find out, you know, what's going on in your world. So thanks for showing up today. Let's talk a little bit about the Kodiak Ambulatory Care Clinic and your role. What kind of services do you provide for people in our community?
Well, primarily we're urgent care, but we do a lot of family medicine. We try to tailor to people that need to be seen the day their illness comes on, or small injuries, lacerations, if they can't get into another clinic or they don't want to go to the ER, we try to offer them another avenue for that care. We try to see people same day as much as we can.
So your folks have been in the community for a number of years, right?
Yeah, but I think about 20 years now.
20 years. You're located down there next to the Orpheum Theater?
Right, yep, downtown. Okay. Yep.
So how big is your staff?
Well, it's usually I have two providers. I'm the main provider. I'm here full-time Monday through Saturday. And then Dr. Theobald is here with us. She's here 3 days a week. And then I have Dr. Curtis Wood, who comes in from out of town. He comes in and covers for like maybe a month period of time. I sometimes have a nurse practitioner on staff here. Right now I don't, but I have in the past.
How many people are in the support staff then?
We have about seven support staff. Before the COVID hit, I actually had more, but I tried to wean my staff down to just essential workers to minimize people's exposure, because I figured if somebody had COVID, they might walk in here, and I just wanted to limit that staff exposure as much as I could. So
Tell me, what is the interaction between you and the ER, for instance? Are you the substitute for the ER if people have, you know, just a sudden urge, they need to have urgent care? They'd have an option to either go to the ER or go to an ambulatory care clinic?
Yeah, we're not a substitute for the ER. There are things the ER can do that we can't do. So we try to maybe, at best, I might say, decompress what they might get. Things that are not emergent, you know, colds or a small laceration. So they can focus more on the more emergent issues, you know, heart attacks, strokes, higher end trauma. We do get people that walk in here that we refer up to the ER because I feel that the severity of their illness or injury warrants the level of care that they can offer at the ER at Providence.
Okay.
Yeah.
So about how many people do you have the walk-in traffic that way, and then you said you have a family care business, so you work like a regular clinic where you have a regular group of people who come there for just to see the doc and get their shots and have regular care?
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have our patients that like to come here. So we usually schedule them, but I always leave openings on the schedule for walk-ins. We see before the COVID hit, we were probably seeing 40 patients a day on the average.
Okay, so you're the primary physician, and Dr. Thebold, did you just come to town? Is that what I understood you to say?
Yeah, I came to I moved to Kodiak in July of last year. Before that, I was up in Nome for 5 years and then moved to Maui for a year and a half and then moved back to Alaska. My husband took a job with Island Air. He's a pilot. And so we had interviewed in Kodiak before we went to Maui and then decided to try Maui. And then we missed Alaska, so we moved back. But yeah, I've been in Alaska, like the native health system in Alaska for a while. And then decided to still work with Dr. Kohler here. And then I've also been doing emergency medicine up in Kotzebue, kind of a week on rotation, and then in Kodiak part-time as well.
Do you do that now?
I haven't been. The last time I was up there was March, and that was right, you know, towards the beginning of March, right when COVID was starting to hit the state. And so they were requiring a two-week isolation period on that end. And then when I had in March, when I got back here, I did another two-week isolation period, and I got tested because I did have some upper respiratory infection symptoms, and I did not want to be patient zero in Kodiak. So that's when I reached out to public health to ask them about, you know, what do I need to do? Obviously isolate, but we decided testing was important too as a healthcare provider here. So now I am just kind of waiting to see what is going to happen with the state before I go back to Kotzebue.
So in essence, is the person in Kotzebue then stuck in Kotzebue too? So they're not short a person there?
Yeah, they have several providers that are based in Kotzebue. And then they also had a pretty decent contracted staff that comes from either Anchorage and or Seattle, you know, other places in the lower 48. They also have a program with Mass General where they bring up ER doctors as well. But exactly right now, it's mostly they are keeping the people that are in Kotzebue are the main ones working on the ground. And then any of their contracted staff does have to come up for that 14-day quarantine period and then can work. So it's definitely made the staff there have to kind of just keep working through all of this while they're waiting for reinforcements.
Yeah. Well, talk to me a little bit about what it's like in a small clinic. How many people do you normally see in the course of a week? Does it vary a lot by injury, walk-in traffic, or do you kind of have a good feeling for how many people in the community kind of usually use your services?
Yeah, well, we see, well, right now we're seeing about 25, 30 patients a day. And it's not walk-in, all their, it's cumulative. So like a lot of them are on telemedicine now. And majority of what we see is acuity care. But we do see people for other things like diabetes, hypertension. I try to keep it non-complicated issues. If they have a more complicated history or medical care plan, I try to keep them with their primary docs in the community, whether it's North Pacific or the community clinic or CANA. Because if these patients need to be hospitalized, some of them have a history of being in the hospital a lot, it's better they stay with their primary in that regard. But if they have a less complicated history and it's pretty straightforward treatment or care, I try to cater to that.
Okay, well, talk to me now about a little bit about the onset of COVID. You know, when you first started hearing about how it was going to affect business and the things that you had to do to try and keep open.
Yes, that was so. That was a process of development. I think it was back in March or end of February. I started looking at you know, the potential of COVID coming to Kodiak, and how is my clinic set up that I can accommodate a patient that might walk in with COVID? So, probably the first thing we had to do is set up a screening at the door. So when patients would come in, we would screen them to determine if they were symptomatic or not. And if we felt they were, we wouldn't let them in the main door. We'd let them in a back door to a separate room so we could evaluate them and keep them separate from other people that were in the clinic and other staff, just trying to minimize their exposure to other people. So that was probably the first change we made. And then every day you're thinking, what more can I do to, you know, I'm thinking more in terms of protecting my staff, because if my staff become ill, you know, then I can't run a clinic. So that was the important thing. We had meetings talking about that, getting PPEs ordered, making sure that they're protected. Because at that time we didn't know, you know, what's the range of this virus? Is it going to come to Kodiak? And if it does, you know, are we going to see the same statistics here as we've seen in other towns or cities? So I thought we did a really good job, my staff, coming together and getting things set up so things could be safe and they would feel comfortable. I offered them, my staff, I would tell them, you know, if you are uncomfortable working here because we're really front line and somebody walks in here with, you know, respiratory symptoms and we're thinking it might be COVID and you're not comfortable with it, you know, you don't have to stay here and work. I understand. You can take a month off and maybe come back later. But they all wanted to stay. They all wanted to stay and work and be a part of it, because that's what they went into medicine for. That's why they became an MA or a nurse. They want to help people. And I think they felt comfortable enough with the protection that we were able to provide them to be able to see patients and take care of them. So yeah, and then probably the biggest change is the telemedicine. You're going from seeing everybody for visits to now we probably 2/3 or 3/4 of the patients we see are all on telemedicine. They're not actually physically coming into the clinic. And I actually enjoy doing telemedicine. It's a little bit more fun.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't have the experience of being able to physically examine them like you want to, but there's a lot of things you can do where you can just talk to the patient. For example, if they have lab results, do they need to come into the clinic to go over lab results? No. You can do that over the phone, or you can do that by telemedicine. And that's more convenient for them. And patients in the past would always say, why do I have to come in to go over my lab results? And part of the answer is that their insurance won't cover that visit if we just do it on the phone. So, as a doctor, you could literally be on the phone most of the day managing patients, but then you can't bill their insurances for that. So I always felt bad about that, having to drag people in here just to go over their lab results. But you need to do that because, if the labs are abnormal, you need to go over that and discuss them. But now, and I'm hoping, it's probably one of the few good things about COVID is that this telemedicine is now up and running and insurances are covering it. I'm hoping it'll stay that way. Because it's much more convenient for the patient. We can do that by phone or by telemed.
It's better use of everybody's time. How do you make an assessment of who's gets to come into the clinic as opposed to who's a telemedicine client?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's stages. So when a patient calls in, the receptionist tries to screen it to see if it is somebody that probably should be seen physically. If she's not sure, she hands it over to the nurse who triages it. And then she might decide that the patient probably needs to come in. Or if she's not sure, she'll put them on the schedule. We'll first start as a telemed visit, and then I might decide when I'm talking to them that, hey, you probably really need to come in today. So there are stages in that triage as to who comes in. I really try to keep people home, keep them, from having to come in here. But sometimes you just have to see them.
Okay.
And when they do, we try to do it one patient at a time. So we don't have, two or three people waiting in the lobby. We try to get them in one at a time. Somebody comes, we triage them at the door, get them in, get them out, and then the next patient coming in. So trying to keeping in line with distance between people, trying to keep people that are ill away from each other as best we can.
Now, in the big picture of things, in compliance, as far as how a small clinic operates in this community and in the statewide community, how do you decide, what you need to do? I mean, is this something you can internally do? Are you part of a collective? You know what I mean? I mean, do you talk to other providers in our community? Is it a state mandate that drives you, or is it you're part of an association of clinics that set out a series of rules?
Well, if you're referring to the mandates.
Yeah, just your general. I mean, when do you decide, given the literature that I'm looking at and the reports that I'm hearing, this is what I need to protect my clinic. Is that a decision that you make here? Yeah.
Yeah. I think most clinics operate that way. They have to decide. First, you have to understand the mandates and then be in compliance with that. But personally, for myself in this clinic, I try to go steps beyond that, and in terms of protecting the staff and protecting patients. So, for example, whichever nurse is going to be managing the patient, I make sure that they dress up head to toe in PPE and protect themselves, not just wear a mask, not just wear a gown, but I want them completely covered. Maybe it's a little overkill, but I want to make sure that they don't, you know, if that patient, I tell them, any patient that comes here, if they're, even if they're asymptomatic, just assume they have COVID. Just play it that way. That way you're going to protect yourself and be safe. And I think that's the best way to go. Now we haven't had a lot of cases here in Kodiak. So, you know, there's a lot of redundancy in it. And sometimes the nursing staff, they, you know, they got to do this all the time. But I still want them to do that. It's just a good habit to be in right now with the what's going on, because we don't know. Things are starting to open up. My concern is, you know, COVID isn't gone yet. It's still out there. So we're heading into a time in Kodiak where people are going to start coming here. We got tourists, the fishing industry, the canneries are starting to turn up. So anybody coming here, people are flying in, you know, for this, and any one of them, it just takes one person that is active with COVID, and maybe they're asymptomatic. There's a lot of asymptomatic people or pre-symptomatic, there's a good chance it will come here. I want to be ready for that. I want my staff to be protected from that. So we're not out of the box yet.
I got two questions before we join a kind of a group discussion here. One is, how are you dealing with the resources, you know, the obtaining the masks and having enough sanitizer and getting all of that thing? Are you able to get what you need as a small clinic? Do you have outside help to help you do that?
Yeah, at first there was a little bit of a struggle, but you just have to be tenacious. Usually we get our supplies through Henry Schein, but they very quickly dried up. So I had to expand and go other places. For example, eBay, Amazon, other distributing companies. And fortunately, one way or another, I was able to find something I needed to purchase so I could get that here to keep everybody protected. The other thing too is a lot of the PPEs are intended to be disposable. And like the N95 masks, usually you wear it and then we dispose it. But because of the shortages, you want to hang on to these. So you can actually treat your PPEs like you can bake them in an oven and sterilize it to a point where you can reuse it. So trying to reuse the PPEs makes you less dependent on your supply companies from having to continually supply you.
So you put it in the oven with your squash?
Yeah. You can actually get a like the towel ovens, towel warming ovens, and Dr. Shanna could probably tell you more about it. Where you can put them in there for a certain amount of time. Oh, go ahead, Shanna.
Yeah, just to answer a couple of your questions, we have been joining the state provider meetings where Dr. Zink and then other kind of public health professionals will inform us, you know, what's the latest updates, what people are doing in their clinics to keep people safe. And that's where, you know, one of the doctors mentioned he did a lot of research about, you know, UV light, using kind of hydrogen peroxide or alcohol-based sterilizers, which kind of break down the effectiveness of the masks. And he said heat was the most important or was the way that they found that would sterilize. You know, they did testing for the viral particles before and after the mask, and after heating was when the mask maintained its effectiveness, and then also there were no more live viral particles afterwards. So we've been following along with the state updates, and then also I'm a member of several physician groups. It's been mostly on Facebook, but both nationally, internationally, and then also the Alaska COVID-19 physician group. And so we're just trying to keep abreast of, you know, all the information of what other clinics are doing, what the CDC recommendations are, what the WHO recommendations are, what state recommendations are. And then we have meetings within our clinic to make sure, you know, we kind of all put our heads together as far as what do we need for PPE? What do we need to make sure, you know, we keep people safe? We have the glass kind of that every store, everybody has right now, the plexiglass protective barriers. And then are also, you know, we have just the one COVID testing room and we primarily use that for COVID testing. And then we move the lab into another place that's kind of separate. So we're really trying to standardize, you know, follow kind of the standard guidelines that are recommended across the board. And yeah, I do wish we could attend the Kodiak. I hope we'll be able to attend the Kodiak meetings and just make sure that we're on the same page with everybody else. But so far, like Dr. Kohler said, we haven't had any active positives. And so we haven't, and I think Alaska's been doing a great job of keeping the curve very flat, and Kodiak, especially with, you know, very few cases. I think if we had any positives, that we would immediately ramp up our, you know, making sure that we're protecting everybody more cautiously and working with the Kodiak crew to make sure that we're testing, you know, mitigating the spread, isolating the people that are positive, making sure that we are really following the guidelines. I think not just following the guidelines, but hopefully, you know, erring on the very extreme side of caution to make sure that we don't prevent it in our small island community.
Okay. We've been into this for 8-9 weeks already now. And we keep waiting, you know, we waited for a long time for the first case to come, and the first case came, and now it seems like there's a lull again. And we're seeing in the community sort of a relaxation. How does the medical in your clinic, how do you keep dealing with, you know, the mental health aspect of it and the anticipation of it? Are you seeing changes in your staff, and how do you keep them pumped up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think everybody, I mean, we're being lax, but we're also trying to test everybody. Anybody who says, you know, I had symptoms in the last month or a couple of months, or I had, you know, a possible exposure, or, you know, like a couple of crews are starting to get workers in from other parts of the state and they're undergoing the 14-day quarantine. But if there's any question at all, we're doing antibody testing. We're offering antibody testing because I think, like Dr. Zink says, the most important thing we do now is test, test, test. Because if we can catch anything or any positives early, then we can also prevent, mitigate the spread and keep the curve flat. I think, you know, the staff has been amazing. And the community here, we do primarily see, I think, a lot of cannery workers. And we just, they are, everybody we talk to about, you know, the importance of the public health. And when we have to test a patient and have them stay home for 14 days, it's really hard for them because they are the primary breadwinner for their family. And a lot of them are living paycheck to paycheck. But at the same time, you know, we take that time to have a conversation with them about the importance of not getting COVID in the cannery workers, and especially seeing all the, you know, meat packing factories in the lower 48 and how that's a place where it will spread like wildfire. So, I mean, when we have the conversation with our staff and with, you know, each patient on the case-by-case basis, everybody is very understanding. And I mean, we're doing the best we can to get the test back quickly so that people can get back to work quickly, but also, you know, making sure that they stay home when they're sick. And a lot of the, like the cannery managers have a really good, they screen with temperature. They, if there's any symptoms at all, like cough, they have the patients get a medical clearance. And if they're, you know, we've had to have a lot of people stay home while they're symptomatic with a cough or any kind of upper respiratory infection symptoms. And I mean, we, you know, it is what it is. It's really tough. But at the same time, I think worse than having people have to stay home would be having COVID-19 spread through this community like wildfire. So it's really that balance. And I think we're trying to err on the side of caution. But people, I would say overall, you know, they understand it. I think it's going to be harder and harder if there are no more cases I think we're just trying to balance it all. Like Dr. Zink said, it's, you know, we want to get back to work. We want to get back to having the community active, but at the same time, we just want to make sure that we don't let it get out of hand.
Okay. Well, let's go into a group discussion then about testing in general. Do Is there any viral testing available at your clinic, or do you all do you only do blood testing?
We have both. We have the PCR, the nasal swab for active virus, and then the antibody testing.
Okay. Elsa, we talked about this in the past, but where are we at with statewide testing and community testing right now? Are we still moving ahead? Are we testing more people?
I think, we are testing more people all over the entire state. I know all the clinics every day are testing folk. I think across the whole state now we're up to 21,000 tests done across the state. So we're picking up cases every day, although not as many right now. So that's kind of where we are.
So statewide, our numbers are still kind of flat.
Right now they are. We're only getting, one, maybe two, some days with zero cases, which is really nice. I think we're all kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. But there's a lot of testing still going on.
And I think there's a lot less excitement in the community to get tested, too, because it has kind of died down a little bit. People are a little less worried. So when we first started testing, there was tons of people who wanted to be tested if they had symptoms or not. And there's not quite the demand that there was before. Even at that time, we had very little supply that we could test people. Now we have more supply, and we're still being careful with it because we think someday, it may not be today, it may not be next month, it may be in the fall, who knows, when we do have a big influx and we need to have tests available. But we are pretty much testing people who have any symptoms or people in who are around high-risk populations or have been exposed, where at the beginning you had to have a long list of things before we'd test you.
So the product flow then, from if you do a PCR test at one of the clinics, it then goes to public health?
So there's several different avenues it can go. It can go to the public health labs, both in Anchorage and Fairbanks, take samples in the regular swabs. They're pretty fast right now because it's lulled down a little bit. So they have a pretty good turnaround, plus they've got more machinery there. Also, the other option is to send it to the commercial labs, both LabCorp and Quest. Many of the others are doing the labs now. And then the third option, of course, are the Abbott ID Now machines and that can do the antibody testing on site, the rapid testing.
That's so, antigen, though.
Antigen, yes. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. The antigen PCRs. So they're still looking for the active virus similar to the lab tests.
So the turnaround time for getting results on the PCR test is how long?
It can be 15 minutes with a rapid ID now, or it can be a week if it's gone to a commercial lab.
So just to be clear, the rapid machines are not PCR.
Oh, they're
PCR is kind of the gold standard that you'd have to send to Quest or the state or ANMC. These rapid tests are very accurate. But the gold standard is still sending it to the laboratories.
So this is the Abbott test that the hospital has and CANA has. And does the community health center have one too?
Yeah, they have them too.
Now, so the federally qualified health centers have them, right?
Okay. So you folks at your clinic are doing the regular, the nasal or the oral swab, right?
And sending it out. The on-site testing for that,
And are you guys going to LabCorp or Quest, or where are you going to? What's your turnaround time?
Dr. Coyle probably has the details.
We use Quest, and the turnaround time is weather-dependent.
Average 1 week, but 5 to 10 days or more.
Still taking a long time. I was hoping they sped up the process a little.
The best is 5 days if everything goes smoothly, but we've had some when Raven closed down, Alaska Airlines shut down for a little bit there, it almost took 2 weeks to get tests sent out to Connecticut.
So what happens to somebody when they come in and they have symptoms and they're getting tested? What's your advice to them prior to getting the results back? Go quarantine yourself for until we get the results back? I mean, do you often, do you send people to the hospital for one of the rapid tests for a second opinion, say? I mean, is that an option?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So far, we've been telling them to quarantine. Most of them have been mild, but I think if we had a really severely ill patient, we would call ahead to the hospital and or public health and see, you know, what the process would need to be. It has been changing all the time, as you know. But I mean, knock on wood, so far we've been fortunate where we screen the patients, we make sure that they have a safe place to quarantine, like they have a room that they can stay by themselves in, and not most of a lot of the cannery workers live like in their own room basically, and so then they quarantine there. But yeah, it really depends on the situation.
Well, I think it's a real positive that of all this testing that's going on and everybody sort of communicating with each other, we're still at the one case. So let's now talk about this antibody testing that you have available down there and how you got involved in that and what value it has to us at this time.
Yeah, so we started for the antibody testing. The state of Alaska and one of their provider meetings, they sent everybody out the list of all of the FDA, you know, emergency authorization approved antibody testing. And so we just went through the list and contacted as many companies as we could that had actual, like, a website or an email address. And then Dr. Kohler was able to secure a couple of different kinds of testing. He can speak more to how that worked, but.
Yeah, probably the most important one was the serology. So there's molecular tests and there's serological testing. And the molecular test being actually testing the virus, the PCR tests. For our clinic, those are the nasal swabs. The serology test, it's a finger poke test. And you can do, our turnaround is, it's a 5-minute test. You do it right here in the office. It's not a good test for somebody who is symptomatic right now, because we're testing their antibodies. So it usually takes 5-7 days for you to start making those antibodies. And they've been finding that people are actually infected, you know, maybe up to 2 weeks before they start mounting immune response or getting symptomatic. So, but if somebody maybe a week, 2 weeks ago had been symptomatic and had been ill and they're wondering, did I have COVID? Do I need to worry, you know, because I've been home with my family, do I need to worry about, you know, did I have it? We can do that test here in the office and see if they're making antibodies to it. So far we haven't had any positive tests. These tests are pretty sensitive, so it gives them option. If they are symptomatic, however, then we do the nasal swab. That's the only way you're going to know. As far as demographics, epidemiologic, they talk about doing more serology testing to see, you know, how much of the population actually had been exposed to this virus. There's more studies coming out about asymptomatic people that are infected, but they don't have any symptoms at all. You know, what percent of people of the population have that? I also seen studies of people that have been infected, hospitalized, and then they're sent home and they're still shedding virus up to 2 weeks after they've left the hospital. So there's a lot of information we're still trying to get on this virus. And I think serology testing is going to be important in the epidemiologic information that we get on this virus.
I think it's also important from the other stand too that I don't know how many patients you guys have had down at your office, Dr. Kohler, but I've had so many friends who are like, man, I thought I had it in December or January Well, now you can have an answer. I mean, these the nasal PCR is great for acute illnesses, but all these guys who tell me, I think it came through in December and January, and we just didn't know about it. Well, there's a way to find out if you're really dying to know.
Yeah.
Do you have people who come in who are just curious about it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite a few. And a lot of them are convinced. They're like, I'm sure I had it. And then so far we've had negatives, which is interesting because it means that we don't have any herd immunity yet here.
Well, we wouldn't have herd immunity unless we started seeing people test positive with the antibody testing, right? I mean, and if you're getting nobody that's testing positive, our herd immunity is zero. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, we're pretty fresh off the fresh,
yeah,
virgin to this coronavirus, and it is going to be it will probably go through the town if we're not careful fairly quickly, just because nobody has any significant immunity to it. And I mean, the truth of it is we don't even know what that means. If you have a positive antibody, probably you're going to have immunity to it. I mean, we don't know exactly for sure. We think some people have speculated that it might give immunity for 2 or 3 years and then it'll start waning. Some people feel like it's a lifetime immunity. But we don't know what it means to have antibodies to this disease. I mean, we had people asking questions, does it help to donate plasma if you have positive antibodies? It's really unclear at this point whether it's helpful or not. Maybe. It's a good theory, and it's good to look at it.
I think that, too, that there are even some thoughts out there that it's not going to provide a lot of immunity, even if you have antibodies. So we don't really know yet how much immunity. And for the plasma, I know that the blood bank in Anchorage is taking people who are confirmed cases and collecting plasma.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
You would have to go up to Anchorage to, if we had somebody who was positive, it would be collected in Anchorage. We don't have that ability here in Kodiak.
So, I'm just curious, what made you decide to delve into the antibody testing machine, you know, to invest in that? At a time when I know that there's been a lot of questions about how accurate some of these machines are, and it seems a bit early, I guess, without having an influx of positive cases here. What benefit is to have one of these machines right now?
The thing is, since we couldn't test as many people as we wanted to when they were symptomatic in February and March, just due to the lack of testing, we didn't know how prevalent COVID-19 was in the community, if it had already, you know, kind of passed through. And the only way to, well, hopefully the only way to know and an accurate way to know is with antibody testing. So that was highly encouraged by, you know, the CDC, and then also, I mean, every state governor and medical director, the chief medical officer, Dr. Zink, you know, recommended that if we could, the more we know, the more we're in a good position to react. And so that was our motivation for getting the antibody testing. A lot of people, a lot of patients, like some of the other docs said, they really believe that they had COVID-19 earlier. They're like, I had a dry cough, I had a fever, I felt awful. And the flu test was negative, or I couldn't get in for a flu test. So I think it will just give us more information. And at this point, it's showing that we probably, we're still yet to see COVID-19.
So from a state point of view, how is all this testing being compiled? I mean, is there a difference between whether something's on a rapid test, a PCR test, a positive test, a negative test, an antibody test? Is all that data being compiled in one place?
So it is all being compiled by our Department of Epidemiology. There's a lot of people working there. So when tests are done, and these guys have their own processes, especially like, for instance, ANMC is collecting data for CANA's ID now, you know, and, you know, the hospital is, and then all those numbers are fed in, just because when it was all going through labs, it was pretty easy. Epidemiology got all those lab slips, but now that we don't have lab slips for all of the testing, It's coming from the individual clinics, usually through spreadsheets or some other form for whoever provided those machines. And so that's how it's being collected.
So the results that you get from the antibody tests, then you send off to the state lab, to Dr. Zink? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the first step was kind of doing this quick test of, does somebody have active disease? The next step is probably antibody testing on mass scales. Mm-hmm. I know ANMC is starting their antibody program right now. And offices like Dr. Kohler's are starting to gather information so we can have an idea which communities are really vulnerable and which are not.
Explain that little part about the program that has just started up about antibodies.
So ANMC is just ready to receive blood products so that we can look to see if they've ever been exposed to it before. I'm not sure how long it takes. I'm not sure what the process is, but they did just start that. It's going to take a lot of people doing it to get an idea of what it's how far this disease has gotten. We look at a study was released from New York State yesterday, where they randomly selected 15,000 people across the state. Some communities had less than 1% antibodies, but places like New York City had 20% antibodies. And so until you figure out those numbers, it's hard to say when you're going to reach a point of, you know, this quote unquote herd immunity, when a community is going to be somewhat resistant to it coming through with a second wave. I mean, I know we've had one person, but we definitely have not even had our first wave yet.
So what is the statewide plan? Is there a plan yet in place for antibody testing?
I don't think that the state has decided on a widespread antibody testing yet. I think that will come down the line, probably starting in the fall or at some point. They will definitely do it. I mean, our epidemiologists are excited about that. I just think it's they're still kind of on the brink of worrying about active disease right now.
So the unit that you folks have, is it a little self-contained machine? What are we talking about? What is an antibody tester?
It's a cartridge. So you poke their finger, put like a drop on it, and then you put a developer and then it runs. It's very similar to like a strep, quick strep test or the influenza testing. And then it runs along a paper, and if a line shows up, it means you're positive. If it doesn't, then it's negative.
Was it a significant investment for you to acquire one of these things?
No, not really. But I'm more interested in the information, the money part. Yeah, initially these tests are expensive, but now that I'm seeing the prices are coming down, they're coming out with more. But that wasn't a part of the determination as whether or not we would get one of these things.
It is in the news, so I mean, we need to talk about it. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of criticism of some of these machines being rushed out by people who are sort of scamming people with machines that aren't accurate.
Yeah, certainly, and so we rely a lot on the FDA that they're looking at these tests and these companies and how they're developing these tests. So you don't want to be purchasing tests from a company that doesn't have that FDA emergency approval. So yeah, and you're right. These are new tests that they don't go through the same rigorous standards the FDA usually does because of the emergency. So you don't know. I would call these companies and ask them, you know, what is the sensitivity of this test? What's your positive predictive value? What's the specificity of this test? And some companies could come right out and give me those numbers. Some would give me semantics. They would say something different. And so I think it's hard because a lot of these tests that have come out don't have large studies to go by. Hurry to get these tests out. They can't do the big studies that they need to do. So they're smaller And so there's more air in it. So you, in a way, you don't really know what the accuracy of some of these tests are. But I think in time, we're going to find that out.
So, Mike, one of the things on the that Evan was talking about with the ANMC doing their tests, they're looking at serology, a large volume of test sample versus a small droplet. And so there's ongoing studies to try and figure out, as Dr. Kohler said, how valid these quick tests are versus that. I think we're really in the infancy of of all of that realm of testing, and it's going to be more useful in the future to say, how's our population doing? Have we been exposed? Are we safe? The immediate stuff is still, we have to rely on the either the rapid ID now test or the PCR test to assess for patients who are symptomatic currently.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you one of the questions, Dr. Kohler, that so you don't get 500 phone calls, because I've had so many people interested in the antibody test. If somebody walks in without insurance and wants to get checked, how much would it cost?
Well, there's actually, it's a good question. That I was reading, there is a way, I think the state actually will pay for that.
Yeah.
I saw it.
So it could be free to the patient?
It could be, yeah. I have to look into that. I just saw it yesterday. But what we do is we discharge them for a nurse visit, and I don't charge them for the actual testing. You know, I don't want the finance to be a barrier to somebody needing to know or wanting to know, did they have COVID or not? So
did they already? I mean, are we seeing more people walk in wanting, you know, that think they're symptomatic, that want a test to see if they have it right now? Or are we now seeing an increase in people saying, I think I had it 2 months ago. Could you test me and make sure?
Yeah, we're seeing less symptomatic coming in, wanting to know if they've got it now, and more. I was at GCI a month ago. I think maybe I had it, that kind of thing. We're starting to see more employers sending people in, that, like, they're getting their fishing boats ready, and somebody just flew in from Minnesota. They did their 2-week quarantine, but before they get on the boat, they want to know, can I let this guy on my boat safely?
What do you think?
It's tough to say with any of these tests. I mean, they've done the 2-week quarantine. It's the antibody test is going to show whether they've ever been exposed to it. It doesn't say, oh, they're definitely safe or unsafe to be on the boat, even if it's a positive antibody test. As far as these rapid machines that we have at the hospital, if that turns out positive, then, I mean, like Dr. Kohler was saying, we've had people shedding virus for 37 days and without symptoms. And so we have no idea how long it's going to take for them, even beyond the 14 days. We picked 14 days because we think that's a fairly safe amount of time to be symptom-free. But it's a lot of this is still unknown.
I have a question. So in the hospital setting, are they using the COVID test as like a pre-op?
So, yes, John, we are. So any patient who comes in for pre-op has, we actually do a double collection. We do the nasopharyngeal swab, which is the more appropriate one for the ID now test. We do that, and then we send a second swab to the state for confirmatory PCR. So any patient who is scheduled for elective surgery or emergent surgery has that test done. Same testing with OB patients, and then currently, we're any patient who we admit to the hospital for other reasons, we're moving towards the stance that we will also test those individuals, even if they screen otherwise negative.
Okay.
And anybody who comes in to deliver a baby is going to get checked. We've actually been trying to pre-screen at our clinic if we know somebody's going to be delivering soon, if we're going to be inducing them or going in for a C-section. We pre-screen them before they even go into the hospital. And so it just makes it, it simplifies things.
So I think one of the changes that I've heard Dr. Kohler and Dr. Theobald talk about, Dr. Jones, is that we have changed our approach to patient care and have to assume that everybody's positive and protect ourselves, it, rather than go maybe or maybe not. And that's a change for all of us. Telemedicine, I'm in the ER, I'm a hands-on person. And so the fact that you guys are talking to people by video conference and making recommendations is a whole new concept for a lot of us.
Yeah, that's true.
Even you want to take a stab at that question we got from a listener?
Okay, somebody is asking, we have a listener asking, many people believe that virus infections have a single bell-shaped curve. Haven't places with high infection rates experienced multiple exponential spikes? You know, is there second waves is what they're basically asking.
That's $1 million question. We don't know.
Yeah. You can look at some models that show that, you know, even like when we've had other bad infectious disease outbreaks, you know, where you'll have one peak, you know, and then it'll die down and then another big peak. And that's why, according to some models, are worried about the fall, looking at, you know, that things will die down and then come back up. But I don't think anybody knows about this virus.
No.
So let's pretend we had our first wave already, which we haven't. But I do expect, unless we get either immunization or 40% or higher antibody positive testing, I think we're going to have second waves. And I think places like Hong Kong have experienced that. They did have a first wave that went through, mm-hmm. contained it. And then they did have a second wave that went through, and they seem to be containing that again now. So this is what we talked about, that at first everything got shut down. But as my hope is that lots of villages, if this disease is going to continue to spread through Alaska, that we don't have tons of villages turn positive at the same time. That we have, like we did before, we have Ketchikan turn positive, and we have a limited number of cases there. And they hunker down there, and it kind of fizzles out. And then maybe we have another small community. The disaster that could happen is if Anchorage has a strong wave going through the same time as a small community does. That's the scary thing to me. It's just more than one community, including Anchorage, having a strong wave of this going through. Because then we get in big trouble, because we ship anybody out who's on a ventilator as quickly as possible. And if Anchorage is full, that leaves us in a tight spot. We'll still take care of patients, and we'll make sure people are treated as well as we can. But it's best if they're in Anchorage, if they have to be on a ventilator.
I'm gonna ask, what value is there in hunkering down continually now if it's inevitable that something's going to come through the community?
I think you still limit your overall exposure to, if you can still maintain that social isolation. I still want people to get outside and do activities for their mental health as well as their physical health. But I think when you use the term hunkering down, to me that means continuously being prepared. You can't be on high alert, but you have to still be prepared. And I think that's where we're at in the community right now, is we need to keep our level of alertness. And we're prepared so that if we do get an influx of patients or cases, we're at least ready. But you still have to remember it's out there. I like the analogy, if anybody's seen Pirates of the Caribbean and the Kraken's out there. You know, it's there.
Don't go to the beach. Is that what you're saying? No.
I do really sympathize with people, though, that it's one thing – if you've got a one of these jobs that's considered necessary or whatever you want to call it. But like Dr. Kohler was saying, there's some people that they're the sole breadwinner, mm-hmm. and ask everybody to stay home when that's their only source of income. The $1,200 check does not go very far in Kodiak, and so I get the need to reopen the economy. But once again, I'd like to reiterate that, you know, if you're a person who's high risk and would not do well with this illness, just because the community opens up doesn't mean that you should go too free and easy yourself, that you may need to have more restrictions on yourself than is asked of the rest of the community. But I get why people need to go back to work. I mean, the safest thing for us all to do would be to never drive a car again, because they're dangerous. But that's not realistic. There's a certain risk that's inherent with life. Somehow we all die. And there's a certain risk with leaving your house. But at the same time, we have to figure out when is that risk worth it and when is it not.
There's a lot of talk, you know, when we first started talking about vaccines, it was going to be available, you know, in a year and a half. And now it seems to be have accelerated somewhat. How much credence do you put in that? I mean, are we still looking at a year and a half for a vaccine, or is there a possibility that this could be somehow miraculously developed by September?
So Oxford has one out that they say is going to be ready by September. I'm still willing to bet it's March or April, though.
Yeah, and I've even seen as late as like late 2021. You know, it just depends on how the trials work. I mean, they have to really test it on a lot of people to make sure it's safe before they roll it out. So who knows?
But for the at-risk population, you know, for the over 70-year-olds and the people that are compromised, really, they can get out and about, but you pretty much have to limit who you're talking to and wash your hands and
use your masks. Yeah.
Your mask. And that's why we wear masks. I'm wearing a mask to protect you, mm-hmm. and Dr. Jones and Elsa. They're wearing one to protect me. So unless you're wearing full protective masks within N95 where you can actually protect yourself, wearing a mask protects your fellow human beings. And that's what I would encourage people to do. You know, some days I go to the store and everybody has a mask on, and the next day I go and I'm like, didn't anybody get the message? Protect everybody else around you. So even though, like Dr. Jones, I hate my mask. It fogs my glasses, but I put it on when I go to the store because I want to protect other people.
What's the mask policy down at your shop? Everybody in there that works there has one. Do all the patients that come in that you see have one on too? Yeah.
If they're symptomatic, they definitely have a mask. And then we try to get every patient. Most of the patients are coming in. I'd say 80-90% patients are coming in with a mask. And then if they don't have one, some of the cannery workers might not have gotten one. So we give them just a surgical mask, which isn't as effective as either an N95 or a cotton mask. But at least it's something like, yeah.
Well, I want to close with it. I have a question here from a listener that's interesting to me because I hadn't seen it before. There is talk about a passport for people who have antibodies. Is anybody familiar with that?
So I've heard about that. The problem is we don't know when that passport expires, and we don't know if it's that good, to be honest. And so it's a passport, but
What does that passport mean?
So people who have been exposed can, the idea is that they could go around without a mask or go to work or things like that because they're theoretically immune to the disease. The tough part is we don't know.
Well, because there's cases of reinfection, is there not?
Once again, that's up for a debate because some of these reinfection cases, they were saying 1-2% reinfection in Wuhan, but some of the early diagnosis were by CT only, not by antibody, not by antigen. And so it was looking at a person saying, yeah, I think they're infected with coronavirus, but we don't know that they were, so we don't. And could people still be getting reinfected even if they truly were infected? Yeah, it's possible. But I think most people believe that there is a level of protection once you've been infected.
Well, so I do have a question here about people. There's some reports about people who have recovered who don't have antibodies, though.
Once again, I'll say, what did they recover from? Did they have? Were they PCR positive, or were they like the lots of people here who say, "No, I know I had it in January," or were they people who, like we talked about, had a CT of their chest and it sure looked like coronavirus or COVID-19, but in reality it was a pneumonia or a flu or something like something else, and they don't have antibodies. We don't know yet.
Okay, well, let's close out this week's with what are you hopeful? What are you worried about right now? What in the news and what in your environment is got you most concerned right now?
Well, I think for all of us, I think for me, is just waiting for that other shoe to drop. You know, as we begin to open things up, just waiting for a rash of cases. You know, and because everybody's really tired of being quarantined and even all these things we've set up and we haven't luckily been able to needed to use. You know, it's just kind of things are settling, and I'm just worried about the other shoe drop, the next wave coming in.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We really haven't had it here, and I'm seeing people getting a little bit lax. I'm worried about the patients that I know if they get coronavirus, they're not going to get through it. So I tell them, you know, please stay home and pray for your neighbor, paint lamb's blood on your Doria tree. Wait for that cloud of COVID to pass your door. And then, you know, because it just hasn't come here. And I'm worried that someone's going to bring it here. People are coming in now. It's like putting a match on dry grass. It's going to take off. Just like Ethan said, the community hasn't been exposed to it, and there's a lot of risk out there.
Even I call the mission and tell them to protect the little lambs.
They only have so many lambs. Lots of goats right now, but not many lambs.
Dr. Shanna?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern is knowing how to balance reopening the economy, which we all agree is so important, and, you know, mental health and people being able to make a living, and also being safe at the same time and not overwhelming the healthcare system. I think finding that balance in such a, you know, it's a novel virus and in such an unknown kind of trajectory, I think that's the tricky part for all of us.
Looks like I'm the last one to comment. You know, the hospital's worried. We're worried about if it hits the community, is it going to just overwhelm everything? And so that's our biggest worry. And what's overwhelming? Is it 3 cases or is it 10? I mean, I think any of those, like John said, can light be the mats that lit the grass fire. So we're concerned about that. To just maintain our readiness, we do practice drills on different things, run through things. Just keeping your level of awareness up is hard to do. And so we work on that. And I know the clinics are too, to not let our guard down, because it's been kind of a nice couple weeks.
I think the big thing for me is I don't worry about this a tremendous amount, because I do feel like people are pretty prepared. Yeah. Dr. Kohler's office, Canada, KCHC, the hospital, they're fairly prepared for this. I guess my biggest worry is that we reopen and it does hit town and people don't take it seriously because, man, last time they told us to hunker down, nothing really happened. That's probably my biggest worry, is that if a first wave comes through and we tell people, hey, head for the home for a little while, they don't take it seriously. But for now, I think opening cautiously and just watching out for yourself if you're high risk, especially Dr. Kohler's telling patients who are high risk just to stay home. Mm-hmm. I think that's good advice. Until we come up with, an immunization for this, that's probably the best thing for a lot of our population, because all of us as physicians absolutely know people who are not going to make it through this if they get infected. And so I think it's good advice.
That's good advice to end the show on, too. I thank you all for participating today. I know the community truly appreciates you giving up your time and your knowledge to give them information that they need to help them through their day and help them understand what's going on. So Dr. Jones, Smith, Kohler, and Theobald, and Elsa DeHart, you have a good, safe week, and thank you. We'll see you again next Wednesday. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.